amazing institute. I'm going to tell you a little bit of my about my recent work on baryon and lepton numbers. And the motivation for this comes straight from the standard model. You surely have seen this, and you're surely aware that the standard model works annoyingly well describing all the data that we know in at least high energy physics. That means we should take the standard model seriously, and in particular the Lagrangian. If you look at the Lagrangian, you find that there are some global symmetries that are not gauged. And this corresponds to a rephasing of the lepton and quark fields, and according to Noether, you can get some conserved charges out of this, baryon number, electron number, muon number, and tauon number. So you have this U1 to the fourth symmetry, just as a global symmetry that comes more or less accidentally by the concept of renormalizability. So you only allow for dimension 4 terms in the Lagrangian and the gauge group representations that we assign because we've measured them like this. You can also rewrite this global symmetry group with a different linear combination of generators, which is a bit more convenient because even though this is a global symmetry at the classical level of the Lagrangian, you find that at quantum level, there are processes called instantons, as shown by Tooft, that break this baryon number plus total lepton number symmetry. Specifically, it breaks it by 3 units in baryon number and 3 units in lepton number. So it's a process, for example, like this. And even though we're fairly confident that this happens theoretically, we have never observed this experimentally and will probably never observe it because all these processes are suppressed by the instanton action over here with a very tiny prefactor. So this is hopelessly suppressed, at least at zero temperature. When you go to higher temperatures, you can get rid of this exponential suppression here and potentially see this, but again, we have not seen this. Moving on, these two flavor symmetries here, we have observed that they are violated by neutrino oscillations. We have seen neutrinos of any flavor oscillate into neutrinos of any other flavor, which can only be explained by breaking both of these groups. So far, we've only observed the breaking of these groups in the neutrino sector. We have not seen muon, charged lepton flavor violation, for example, muon to electron positron or some decay like that, which is perfectly fine because it could be that the Lagrangian of the slightly extended standard model that gives you neutrino masses only breaks this flavor group with the neutrino mass matrix. And then all the charged lepton flavor violating processes would be horrendously suppressed by typically 2 powers of the neutrino mass matrix. So there is a good chance that we'll never observe charged lepton flavor violation, or at least it's not necessary to observe it. Still, we know it's broken from neutrino oscillations. That brings us to this final piece here, B minus L, which is perfectly fine as a theoretical symmetry. It's anomaly free. And we've not observed any violation experimentally yet. So as far as we know, B minus L could be an actual good new quantum number, perfectly conserved. This only works if neutrinos are Dirac fermions, because obviously this in particular conserves lepton number. And you can even get a Dirac leptogenesis mechanism if neutrinos are Dirac fermions without ever violating B minus L. So even the fact that we have a matter-antimatter asymmetry in our universe is perfectly compatible with the fact that B minus L could be a conserved quantum number. Since it's anomaly-free and apparently conserved, you can think about promoting it to a gauge symmetry, which you can just do for free, basically, after you introduce the 3 right-handed chirality partners for the Dirac neutrinos. So let's consider unbroken U1 B minus L as a gauge symmetry. You have a new Z prime to look for. It has a gauge coupling G prime. And even though it's unbroken, we can still add a Stueckelberg mass for the Z prime. So it has some mass that we don't know because it's not connected to anything. It's not connected to a symmetry breaking scale, so it's just a free parameter. And if the mass of this Z prime is very, very light, you have a long range force over here, and you have very good constraints on this gauge coupling from tests of the equivalence principle and for tests of gravity, how it acts on these kind of scales, micrometer scales. And the gauge coupling then has to be tiny. This has to be a force that is much, much weaker than gravity. But if you go to larger masses, you find that the gauge coupling is no longer crazy small and only a little bit smaller than what you would expect. And you get constraints from stellar cooling in particular. And then up here.
Why is the red line?
So there's 2 kinds of stellar cooling constraints. This one is adopted from hidden photon limits. This only takes into account that the Z prime in this mass region is light enough that you can emit it in stars, so it itself can cool the star. But just from the fact that the Z prime also couples to right-handed, practically massless Dirac neutrinos, also the right-handed neutrinos give you a cooling constraint, and this goes flat. Yes. Okay, then for masses above MeV, you have more terrestrial experiments. For example, electron neutrino scattering, you have beam dumps, and you have BABAR, which is an electron positron collider, and even up here in the tiny corner, LHC and LEP constraints. But as you can see, most of these collider and scattering constraints are excluded by this blue line. And this blue line is a measurement of ineffective at the time when the universe was like 1 MeV hot at the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And this is again the same as this stellar cooling constraint. You can produce these right-handed massless neutrinos in the early universe very efficiently for gauge couplings above the blue line. So you easily double the amount of effective number of neutrinos in the early universe because you have a Z prime that couples very efficiently to the rest of the standard model bath and couples unsuppressed to this right-handed neutrino helicity. So, yeah.
So you break this symmetry spontaneously.
No, we don't break it. This is unbroken. This is just a Stückelberg mass term. That's why it has to be Dirac neutrinos. That's why this constraint kicks in. And as you can see, this dominates the entire region that we would like to probe on Earth with the terrestrial experiments, right? So it's a bit annoying, but also tells you that you are very sensitive to Dirac neutrinos with this ineffective parameter. And in fact, there are efforts to improve ineffective measurements at the CMB age in CMB stage 4 experiments, which are allegedly sensitive to ineffective down to contributions to ineffective down to 0.06, which would probe basically the entire parameter space above like 10 to the minus 9 gauge coupling. So this entire region will be probed with CMB stage 4 experiments, which is good because it probes a lot of new parameter space. But it's bad if you want to motivate new searches in electron neutrino scattering or something like that. I'm guessing most of you have not seen this constraint because the unbroken B minus L case is not something that people usually consider. 99.999% of the literature deals with broken B minus L. And not just broken B minus L, but specifically broken by 2 units, because this allows you to give a Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrinos. And if you make this mass term higher than MeV, you can get rid of this. Because if it's heavier than MeV, it doesn't contribute anymore to the effective degrees of freedom in the early universe. And only the Z prime itself, if it's lighter than a couple of MeV, would contribute. So the bound changes from this to this. Suddenly you open up this entire region of parameter space. And of course, that's not the reason why people do it. The reason why people do it is if you have this right-handed neutrino Majorana mass term, you also get the seesaw mechanism for the active neutrinos. So you split the 6 degrees of freedom that were in the 3 Dirac neutrinos into 3 light active neutrinos and 3 heavy, mostly right-handed Majorana neutrinos here. And this can give you a nice motivation for why the neutrino masses are so small if you make this right-handed neutrino mass sufficiently heavy. In this case, the Higgs of B minus L carries 2 units of B minus L and couples directly to the right-hand neutrinos and gives you this Majorana mass term. And then it's just like seesaw for the rest of the story. So breaking B minus L gives you nice Majorana neutrino masses and opens this parameter space. So let's zoom into this newly open parameter space. This is basically the same as here. Nothing has changed much in the last 4 or 5 years. You still have these beam dump constraints. These are very old. You have Texono here. This is neutrino electron scattering. This is an experiment in Taiwan. You have BABAR here, electron positron collider. And this is the main new thing. LHCb is starting to probe down into this region over here. And up here, you also have the actual LHC, ATLAS, and CMS dileptron searches. So even though not much, except for this LHCb thing, has changed in the last years, there is potential to probe it in the future because the now running Bell 2 experiment will significantly push down these limits and probe.
Just remind us, Texono is when they stick the his experiments next to the
reactor. So Bell 2 will probe a lot. Atlas, CMS, LHCb, they will push down over here. And the phaser experiment, which was just recently conceived and developed at UCI, is also going to be built at CERN and will probe basically like a beam dump this region of parameter space. For the other ones, we don't know whether they're going to be built. SHIP, for example, would be nice, but not clear yet. But even without it, you can see that there's a lot of improvement going on in the next couple of years. As a reminder, all of this newly opened parameter region is only there because we have broken B-L and Majorana neutrinos, which also tells you that if you find something here, that basically proves, if you find a B-L gauge boson here, that basically proves that neutrinos are Majorana particles. Because otherwise, if they were Dirac, you would have seen this long ago in ineffective. You can also show that if you're very close to the current limits here, to the gray region, it's very difficult to have standard leptogenesis using the right-handed neutrino masses that then decay into leptons and antileptons. That is difficult. So if you find something here, that's going to be an interesting task for model builders to find a better mechanism for leptogenesis. But OK, so broken B-L gives you more parameter space to probe, but it does something more conceptually. And for that, let's go back to the standard model global symmetry without B plus L, because that's broken. As I said, if you introduce right-handed neutrinos, this entire group here is anomaly-free. You can gauge these three U1 groups just by adding three right-handed neutrinos, which is basically the cheapest new gauge group that you can ever get. You can get it for free by just having massive neutrinos, which you want anyways, and then you can promote the whole thing to a gauge symmetry. Now, since we know from neutrino oscillations that this flavor part is broken, if you also assume that B-L is broken, there's no reason to assume that these gauge bosons would stay in their flavor basis, right? If you break this entire thing, there's no reason to assume that they wouldn't mix with each other and then lead to some Z primes that have a coupling to a linear combination of these three generators. So just conceptually, breaking B-L allows you to consider flavored B-L gauge bosons, just because you need to break the whole thing anyway. Let's see how that changes the signatures and potential limits. The main thing is that now your Z prime couples lepton flavor non-universally. Right? You now couple differently to muons, tauons, and electrons if you have a mix in of these flavor groups, which changes things significantly, as we will see.
But there is also an ambiguity of what you call mu and what you call tau, right? I mean, like when people say all mu minus all tau, right? We normally assume a certain mass basis, right? But the anomaly cancellation doesn't tell you like the distribution of, it's like L1 minus L2, right? That's all we know.
Yeah. That is the same as saying we don't know that this is the right basis for the generators. You can pick any other linear
mass
combination.
So
yes.
The mass can be off diagonal in
yes.
that basis, right? Which would...
Correct. This is sufficiently general to say that this is the most general anomaly-free U1 product of gauge groups that you can put, but then you don't know which Z prime couples to the linear combination. That's exactly what I said. So we don't know that this is the right basis, for example, M1 is L tau. No one tells you that this is the right generator. So you have to consider a mixture of all of them. And since that, especially if you include kinetic mixing, corresponds to a five-dimensional parameter space, it's kind of difficult to visualize that. So instead, let's look at the corners of this parameter space. Let's look at linear combinations that give you extreme examples for new signatures, just so that we don't miss anything when we search for it. And we start with linear combinations of this that contain electron number. If it constrains electron number, it basically looks the same as before for B-L. So you have, again, constraints on from beam dumps, from Texono, which is just neutrino electron scattering, and from Barbar. Because all these experiments just look at the coupling of electrons to a new Z prime. So all of these limits basically apply to B minus 3 times LE, or LE minus L mu, or LE minus L tau, or just B minus L. The limits are always the same because here you only probe electron couplings. So whenever you have a linear combination that contains electron number, this is going to be the constraints, and the projected sensitivity you can read off from the B minus L plot that I showed before. So this is not super interesting because we're already looking for this. So let's look at linear combinations that don't contain LE. As an extreme example, let's look at something that only contains L tau. So B minus 3 times L tau is an anomaly free linear combination that doesn't couple to electron number. And naively, the limits are very, very weak. You don't want to make the Z prime too light because then it itself starts to contribute to ineffective. But as soon as you're above a couple of MeV, the limits are weak, from just coupling to baryon number or just coupling to taus.
How about atmospheric production of mu mu that oscillates to new tau, and then you'd be looking for it with the electron recoil and the super K, right? At least to the weak, to the effective coupling, and then it probably to the weak scale.
That could be, but turns out to be irrelevant for what I'm saying next. So it turns out these are the limits that you get from just coupling to baryon number or just coupling to tau number. But since we're forced to put it together in this anomaly-free combination, you find that there's a new, qualitatively new signature that you get from these two couplings together. And that is neutrino of tau flavor scattering via the Z prime off of protons and neutrons, baryons. The important thing is that only tau neutrinos scatter like this. The muon and electron neutrinos don't see the Z prime, so they don't scatter on baryons with this new channel. Which means if you have neutrinos that go through matter, only the tau part of the neutrino sees this additional scattering matter potential. And more generally, this is known as non-standard neutrino interactions. And there was a recent great paper by Ivan Esteban and Michele Maltoni where they did a global fit to all neutrino oscillation data, including solar neutrinos, long baseline neutrinos, reactor neutrinos, all of that, and all the information that we have, giving constraints on these NSI. Applied to our model, this gives you a lower bound of 5 TeV on mass of the Z prime over gauge coupling, completely dominating the parameter space. Orders of magnitude better than any other limit that you could get, just from the fact that with this anomaly-free combination, you have a lepton non-universal coupling of neutrinos to matter. And this gives you crazy sensitive constraints because we know neutrino oscillations so well by now. The same is kind of true if you replace muons, if you replace tauons here by muons. If you have B minus 3 times L mu, you still have that muon neutrinos scatter differently in matter, and you still get a, albeit slightly weaker, constraint from NSIs that dominates a large part of the parameter space, at least from the couple of MeV region to like 100 and some MeV here. And in particular, is strong enough to exclude you from using the Z prime to explain the G minus L2, the G minus 2 magnetic moment of the muon. So it's already a critical. Critically important limit. It turns out the NSI limits are weakest when you couple with the same strength to muons and tauons. So let's consider a linear combination like this. You still have strong constraints from NSIs, but you also get new constraints from coherence, recent measurements of coherent elastic neutrino nucleon scattering, which they used for scattering of electron and muon neutrinos on nuclei. And there you can see they even dominate over this NSI constraint in some part of the parameter space. So it's not just the neutrino scattering matter that is relevant. It's also the new coherent measurement and their subsequent improvement that that probes these kind of lepton non-universal forces. Yeah?
Is that still just a matter of vector that you're directly looking for scattering through this new force?
That's a detection. So they use neutrinos from stopped pions, and then they measure the recoil of the nucleus. And since they are very sensitive, they can measure this very, very small recoil from the coherent scattering on the entire nucleus. But this is an honest-to-God terrestrial scattering experiment. So, the lesson so far. If you have a linear combination that couples to electron number, you just get the limits from B minus L, beam dumps, neutrino electron scattering, and bar bar, etc. If you couple not to electrons but to baryons, you still get strong constraints from neutrino scattering, but in this case it's not on electrons but rather on matter, using the interference that you get from neutrino scattering through large amounts of matter, or from coherent. So in all cases, neutrino scattering is crucial to constrain these new things. And in all cases, the region where you would explain G minus 2 is completely excluded. So this was if you couple to baryon number or electron number. This leaves exactly one linear combination of anomaly-free lepton numbers that is not constrained by any of this. And it's very special. And this is L mu minus L tau, which has gotten a lot of attention in the recent years because it is the weakest constrained new Z prime that you can write down without much effort, that you can gauge basically for free. In this case, the limits are so weak that for a long time, the best limit simply came from the one loop contribution to the muon's magnetic moment. And since this happens to have a 3 to 4 sigma deviation between experiment and theory, it was used to explain this. So if you want to explain the muon G minus 2, you live on this green region over here. This is the longest standing anomaly that, that I'm aware of, at least. And luckily, we are about to learn more about this. So this deviation still is dominated on the experimental side by an experiment at BNL. Now they're redoing the experiment at Fermilab. They've already finished their first run, and they're going to publish their first run result, which already contains more data than the old BNL result, by the end of the year or at least like early next year. So within a year, we will hopefully learn something new about the status of this anomaly. If it turns out to be true, L mu minus L tau is the only Z prime nowadays that can explain the deviation. And as such has become a target for new experiments. So
what does it do for H tau?
Okay, I'll come to that. But first, so since this was for a long time now the only explanation for G minus 2, people have looked in this parameter space and have found new constraints. In particular, Maxime and others have pointed out that there is still a neutrino scattering constraint, even though you only couple two muons and tauons, because if your neutrino is energetic enough, you can make your own muons and scatter off of them. This goes by the name of neutrino tridents, and even though the data is not as good as for all the other scattering experiments, you can still get strong constraints here. This is the black line and the gray region above it, which still excludes, despite the limited data that we have, still excludes basically a G minus 2 explanation above a couple of hundred MeV. So you have to live in this low mass region over here between MeV and 100 MeV. And this is precisely the region where new experiments are going to probe this thing. In particular, Bell 2, already running, will conclusively probe this entire region together with all the other experiments. So if the anomaly stays true in the next year, we will soon know whether G minus 2 is explained by this L mu minus L tau.
How does Bell probe it?
How does Bell probe it?
That region is missing energy, so it's the equivalent statement that they can probe like epsilon to gamma 6 or something, which is a clarified part.
Yeah, they go even lower. It's just that I cut it off at the 10 inverse Artaban thing here, so it fits on the plot. But they claim that they can probe it to even lower things with their full run. I forgot. It's a recent paper by the collaboration. This is not some theorist estimate. But I forgot what the actual measurements. As you say, it is missing energy. There's nothing else that they can do in this. So let's come to the H0. This, as we heard over lunch, might no longer be an anomaly, but still was when I made this plot. And people showed that you can explain this deviation of the Hubble rate in local measurements and Hubble rate at CMB by having a little bit an effective in addition, if you have it at the right time. So here you are not in the ineffective excluded region, but you still contribute a little bit to ineffective, just enough to explain this discrepancy. This comes from a paper by Dan Hooper, but other people have pointed out the same thing, that a little bit of ineffective at the right time can explain this. So that's why.
Right time meaning it's all early times, right?
Yeah, it's around the time of the BBN.
Yeah.
MEV masses and yeah.
So in that sense, it's as early as it gets. It's not like you choose the moment between, say, decoupling and equality, right?
It's
as early as it gets, right? It could be as
you can say that, but
any other model, right? With ineffective being generated at the TV scale or 100 TV scale, doesn't matter. Right?
Yes, if you contribute enough ineffective, you can do it at any time. If you want to compensate for the entropy dilution.
Did they run like an analysis with the CMB code?
I doubt that very much. But they're not the first ones to point out that a little bit of ineffective helps. And they just pointed out in this specific model, L mu minus L tau, you get this at this energy range. That's the whole point of the paper.
It's too early to.
But it might no longer be relevant anymore. Doesn't matter. I'm not really going to talk about this anymore. I'm just pointing out here the star. This is a benchmark value I will use later on. This explains the G minus 2 anomaly. And you can also use it to explain H0 at the same time. But it doesn't matter. So you're going to see this benchmark point again in the future. There's another favored region. And this again goes back to Maxime and others, where you could explain the LHCb B2S anomalies. Because you have a Z prime that only couples to muons and tauons, you easily explain any lepton non-universality in muons. The only thing you need, this doesn't work out of the box, is you need to generate a coupling of this Z prime to B and S in order to get contributions to this B to S mu mu decay that you want to explain these anomalies. And this you can get, for example, from vector-like leptons that mix with the quarks and then have their own little Z prime coupling, and then you inherit the coupling from them. Or you can introduce more scalar doublets and extend the symmetry group a little bit to the quark sector, and then you can generate, again, Z prime couplings to Bs. So this is more the high mass region, because this all comes down to you integrating out the Z prime and then generating effective operators above the B meson scale. So you need to be above here in the 100 GeV to TeV range. So this is another benchmark point you will see later. It could be used to explain these B2S mu mu anomalies if you generated these additional couplings. What was I going to say? This already brings me to a mini summary of what I said so far. So this is the global symmetry group of the standard model. You can gauge it basically for free, which makes this one of the simplest UV complete Z prime models that you can think of. If you have neutrinos that are Dirac particles, these Z primes are expected to put them in equilibrium at some point in the early universe, which should then contribute to an effective measurable in CMB stage 4 experiments, or the couplings have to be ridiculously tiny. If instead you have Majorana neutrinos, you open up a more testable range of signatures, and many of them are connected to neutrino scattering. For example, you have neutrino scattering in matter if you have lepton non-universal couplings, or you have neutrino scattering on electrons or nucleons in more terrestrial experiments. The one massive exception, the one special case in all of these cases is L mu minus L tau, because it's so weakly constrained that it's the only thing that can still contribute to G minus 2 in order to resolve the anomaly. And since it's so weakly constrained, it will also play a role in other things, as I will show later. So far, these were only the Z prime couplings to standard model particles, right? But the obvious next question is, can these Z primes also have dark matter couplings? And since we're using this as the Z prime gauge group, it's equivalent to asking, can dark matter carry baryon or lepton number? And of course, the answer is yes. And you want to do this for two reasons. One, if you couple dark matter to the Z prime, you have this as a portal, right? You have dark matter coupling to the standard model, so you can use the Z prime to get the right annihilation cross section, to get the right relic abundance in a thermal way or even freeze in. Doesn't matter. More interestingly, you can use the dark matter charge under this new U1 to make dark matter stable. You don't have to impose a Z2 stabilizing symmetry by hand, but you can pick the right charge under the new U1 that makes it stable by a gauge symmetry, completely protected from like quantum gravity effects or anything. So this is nice. You have dark matter stability from a gauge symmetry instead of putting it in by hand. And as an example, let's go back to B minus L. You can easily convince yourself that all standard model fermions are odd under 3 times B minus L, whereas all bosons have zero charge under B and L, so they are even in particular. That means if you introduce a new fermion that has an even 3 times B minus L charge, it has to be stable because it can't, without violating Lorentz symmetry, decay into odd standard model fermions. Or you can add a boson with an odd 3 times B minus L charge, and it will also be stable unless it acquires a vacuum excitation value. And this is absolute stability. This is not just like the proton, an accidental thing that could be violated at higher order in higher dimensional operators. This is actually completely stable. And again, in addition, you have the Z prime coupling as a portal between the dark sector and the hidden sector, so you can use the standard freeze out arguments to get the right abundance of your dark matter particle. And in the B minus L case, you also couple directly to quarks, so you have this very unsuppressed direct detection scattering cross section. Many people have worked on this, and this is just one example. For Dirac fermion dark matter with 1 TeV mass or 3 TeV mass, as a function of the Z prime mass and the Z prime gauge coupling. You want to live on the green line because that's where you get the right relic abundance. And you can clearly see the resonance where the annihilation cross section here is enhanced because you have the right mass here to hit the Z prime resonance, which allows you to go to smaller gauge couplings to get the right relic abundance. And as you can see, you need to be in this resonant region to evade dileptron constraints from the LHC and, more importantly, direct detection limits from xenon 1 ton. You're kind of forced to sit on this resonance, which is not just a feature of B minus L, but is pretty general nowadays for Z prime portals to the dark sector. You basically always have to sit close to the resonance nowadays if you want to have a Z prime as a mediator.
If you break it a little bit and split the states of guys, then you don't have
this. Absolutely right. So even without this, you have a simple WIMP model and you get you can hope to see it in the direct detection in the next generation direct detection experiment. You can soften the whole thing if you break B minus L again, split the dark matter into 2 Majorana particles, because then you get a velocity suppressed direct detection cross section, which suppresses the whole thing by another factor of 10 to the minus 6 or so, which then easily softens this needed Z prime resonance. So again, breaking B minus L opens up the parameter space and allows you to do more. Breaking B minus L is also interesting because this allows you to embed the whole thing in larger gauge groups. As most of you probably know, B minus L is a subgroup of the left-right symmetry group and even the SO10 grand unified theory group. And it turns out that even if you embed the whole thing into SO10, for example, the stability argument still works. So you can just take your standard non-supersymmetric SO10 model and add a representation that has particularly even or odd, depending on whether you want to add fermions or bosons. And the lightest of these particles in the multiplet will still be stable. As an example, in the just standard SO10 model, you can add fermions in the 10 representation of SO10, or 45, or 54, or 120, or 210, or 210 prime. All of these fermions will have one stable component in the multiplet, stabilized by the same B minus L symmetry that we used in the toy example before. And the nice thing is that not only do you have a stable particle, but in this case, since it's part of a bigger multiplet, you again couple to gauge bosons, but now not only neutral gauge bosons, but also charged, colored gauge bosons, which you can use to test the whole thing better, because it also implies that the dark matter has some charged or even colored partners that come from the same multiplet and could sit at lower scales and are obviously easier to probe than just the neutral WIMP. In all cases, you need some of the groups to be rather low, simply by the unitarity argument for standard thermal dark matter, right? You can't use the actual gut scale gauge bosons to get the right abundance of new particles. You need something below 100 TeV in order to get thermal relic dark matter. But it's possible to do this. All right, so this was B minus L. Let's go to the same thing basically holds if you use other linear combinations of the generators that include baryon number. Let's go to the more extreme case of L mu minus L tau. Because in this case, you can use the same argument to make the dark matter stable. But since the symmetry is much less constrained and the dark matter and the Z prime particle can be very light, you have more freedom in the parameter space. You can easily get the right relic abundance, and you can easily evade constraints because, since you're only coupled to muons and tauons, you don't have any direct detection constraints. This dark matter only sees muons and tauons. So where do you see this?
Well, at one loop level, you have that, right?
In all cases, you have additional kinetic mixing, which I set to zero because I want to look in these corners of parameter space where it's most difficult to see it. Adding kinetic mixing or adding the one loop kinetic mixing always makes it easier to see stuff. So this is not the...
Wouldn't it be generated by running? I mean, if you have your
yes.
completions, so isn't it unnatural to consider that it's zero?
It's generated from the mass of the tau to mass of the muon. So
yeah, so it's always there.
It's there, it's small. It's
no, but I'm saying that, so for many of these U ones that you're considering, there's going to be a U, if you have a U, that UV completion, in many cases generated by running.
Well, for mu minus L tau doesn't work. It doesn't, there is no running above the mass of the tau. These two diodes cancel. For B plus L or B minus L.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Be,
right?
So that's why I'm saying that, yeah.
So let's forget about the gut embedding. I'm not using most of that. But for any U1, you have kinetic mixing at tree level and typically also at loop level.
But it's really necessary that you have tuning to assume that it, I mean, for me, it's a tuning to assume that it's zero at those energies. I see what Maxim is saying about the... Well, how small is it? It's the log of the ratio.
It's this. So in the L mu minus L tau model, the finite one loop correction is given by the log of tau muon mass, and then it's proportional to the G prime, right? The gauge coupling, because you still couple to the Z prime here. But again, why focus on the one loop? You have a tree level thing. So the whole thing, you also have two loop and three loop corrections. The whole thing is a free parameter.
You know, if you want to go what Min is saying, below the natural size of this log, you would assume some finely tuned cancellation between tree level epsilon and the log, which of course can happen, but it's a less natural point.
You can say that. I'm fine with that. I don't care about fine tuning or anything like that. In the end, it's a free parameter plus something else, which is still a free parameter. So I'm setting the whole thing to zero, including all the other loop corrections, just to get the most extreme Z prime that is most difficult to observe. Okay. Because even in this case, if you only couple to muons, it turns out it's not completely invisible to our universe. Because, as pointed out recently by several groups, neutron stars contain muons in a large number. Easily 1% of the neutron stars can be muons, 10 to the 55 stable muons. Stable for the same reason as the neutrons are stable, because it's a degenerate Fermi gas that has a large lepton chemical potential that stabilizes these things. So you have this macroscopic number of stable muons that only reside in neutron stars, not in the sun, not in the Earth. So this dark matter thing only sees neutron stars. And it sees them and can be captured by them. Because you have so many of them, even small cross-sections are enough to capture this dark matter on the neutron star. And if you want to do it a little bit more carefully, you also have to take Pauli blocking and the velocity distribution of the dark matter into account.
This is for first moments of existence of neutron stars?
This is an old neutron star.
Oh, the chemical potential is so low. So the muons are there even for a small temperature. Not the first moment, so, right? Yeah.
Even now, even in cold neutron stars, billion years old. It depends, of course, a little bit on the equation of state of the neutron star that you take.
Well?
Potentially, yeah. That's a little bit more uncertain. And again, so it depends a little bit on the equation of state that you use, but by now, pretty much all equations of state agree that there is some significant amount of muons.
Neutron star without the muons, there will be an instability towards per production until
yes, beta decays.
Both sides,
yeah.
Right? You're saying that both sides of muons there.
No, just negative muons. They, together with the negative electrons, compensate for the protons in there.
All right. Okay, I got it.
So together they make it neutral. All right, so let's do this a little bit more carefully. The capture rate on a neutron star. Dark matter comes in with basically zero velocity. It falls into the gravitational potential of the neutron star, scatters on the muons, loses energy, and then eventually thermalizes with the rest of the neutron star matter. But that doesn't even matter at this point. This is just the capture rate. This here, the dashed black line, is the geometric rate, which just gives you the maximal capture rate. If you suck up every dark matter particle that comes in the way of the neutron star, this is what you get. So you can never get more than this. And the colored lines are for different Z prime masses here, what the model capture rate is. Obviously, if you're above the dashed line, you just saturate to the geometric cross section, geometric capture rate. As you can see, not surprisingly, the capture rate is DOM is maximal if you have a dark matter candidate with the same mass as a muon. Just kinematically, this is the standard pool table argument, your scattering is most efficient. And for higher dark matter masses, the whole thing drops like this. You always feel this Z prime mass to the 4 here. This is why it scales like that for the different masses.
Is there a simple way to understand why there are mu minuses there in the small temperature?
The sign of the chemical potential. I don't know why.
The chemical potential is just a large number of neutrons, protons, and so you're saying that if I get rid of these muons, they get regenerated somehow? What are the, is there enough energy to do that?
Yeah, the chemical potential of the neutrons is in
Yeah, it's so just yeah, it's just above the mass.
Electrons and the neutrinos are not fast there, right? I mean,
but doesn't it have to do with the Pauli
experiment?
Yeah.
Very fast.
Yeah,
right.
Very fast.
So, okay. Are you saying that even though the temperature is not large and the Fermi surfaces are all very thin, there is enough momenta, right, I guess, in the electron and the nuclear fluids to make the muons.
Right? Yeah.
I don't doubt, I just, I'd like.
Yeah, it's pretty surprising. I was shocked when Raghuveer told me about this. So for lighter than muon mass dark matter, you also have to take Pauli blocking and all of these things into account, which makes the actual calculation more difficult, but I won't really go into this region so much. The point is that in most thermal dark matter regions of parameter space, you easily saturate this geometric capture rate. You easily get enough capture that you just suck up everything. So let's go with that. If you just capture all the dark matter in your way, it doesn't matter anymore that you got it from scattering on muons or protons or neutrons. The whole discussion now is just the well-known what happens to dark matter in neutron stars discussion. So let's say you suck up everything. you could hope, and this was done many years ago by Chris Guvaris and Peter Tinyakov, that for asymmetric dark matter that doesn't annihilate, you can just keep collecting enough dark matter to eventually collapse into a black hole, which then eats the neutron star. So you can get limits on the scattering cross section from the observation of very old neutron stars, for which this hasn't happened. It turns out this works not really for fermions, because you have an additional Fermi pressure there that requires you to collect a lot of dark matter to collapse, or to have dark matter masses that are much, much above the standard thermal values in order to give collapse, in order to collapse in the neutron star. So for fermions in the thermal dark matter regime, this is not really relevant. For bosons, you seemingly don't have this Fermi pressure, so it should be easier to collect enough dark matter to lead to a collapse. But as pointed out again by Peter and Chris Guvaris, and then by Nicole Bell and others, in the boson case, you can't really argue away the self interactions. Even if you just have a 5^4 term in your scalar potential, this alone gives you repulsive self interactions that are easily dominant in the Chandrasekhar limit. Even if this lambda in the lambda 5^4 is like 10^-20, the repulsive self-interactions are so strong that you again need a lot of dark matter to lead to a collapse, which again leads you in the parameter regions for very heavy dark matter. So just generically, thermal bosonic dark matter will not give you any constraints from the collapse into a black hole. Or to be more fair, the whole discussion now depends on how big are these self-interactions. If you have attractive self-interactions, you can probably make it easier to collapse, but it now depends on all these additional things. So this might not be the best signature to look for. But even without this, you still get an effect just from the dark matter falling into the chemical, into the gravitational potential of the neutron star and then losing its energy there. And this was pointed out by Joe Bramante, that it could give you heating of the neutron star, because this provides an additional way to get energy into the neutron star via scattering, and this could easily lead to temperatures, apparent temperatures, blackbody temperatures of order of 2000 Kelvin, as compared to much lower temperatures that you would expect if there wasn't any dark matter around. They would just cool down to sub-1000 Kelvin temperatures, if there wasn't any dark matter. So if you see an old neutron star with temperature below 2000 Kelvin, you can get constraints on the cross section with muons in this case.
Muons are returning to the same thing, are stable because the path for the decay is blocked.
Is blocked by the electrons.
By the Fermi sphere.
It's exactly the same as for the neutrons, right? They can't decay for phase space reasons. It is cute. So again, just from infalling of the dark matter, you can heat the neutron star. And if it additionally annihilates in the neutron star, this provides more heating if the decay products don't leave the neutron star, which kicks you up to like 2500 Kelvin. Importantly, we have not measured this, right? We have not seen such old neutron stars with such low temperatures. But in principle, there's this James Webb Space Telescope that's supposed to launch in, I think, 2 years, that has the potential to measure these infrared temperatures if such an old neutron star was close enough by. So there are chances to potentially observe temperatures around this in the future. How would that look in our UV-complete model of L mu minus L tau dark matter? This is the benchmark point for heavy Z primes that I showed you before. So this could be relevant for the B2S anomalies, but it doesn't really matter here. You have the complex scalar dark matter mass here, but it looks the same for Dirac mass. And this is the charge under the gauge group of the dark matter particle. Everything above 0.8, I think it was, will lead to maximal capture in the neutron star. So unless you're sitting in the resonance, your dark matter will be captured on the muons in the neutron star in this model. In addition, if you're on the black line here, you get the right thermal abundance for symmetric dark matter. If you have larger couplings, so in this orange region over here, you need an additional asymmetry to get the right abundance of dark matter because you're over-annihilating your dark matter away. So in the orange region, you are asymmetric dark matter, so you only gain neutron star heating from the infalling, from the kinetic heating. Whereas on the line, you have standard self-annihilating dark matter, and you additionally heat the neutron star up a little bit more from the decay, from the annihilation into muons, tauons, and even neutrinos. At these energies, even the neutrinos don't leave the neutron star. So again, if you see a neutron star close enough by with with temperatures lower than this, this entire region is excluded.
How does this compare with your standard indirect detection constraints? Just direct annihilation.
Right. In this case, it happens that there are basically no indirect detection constraints on this. And this comes from the fact that we have scalar dark matter here. So for masses above the Z prime, the annihilation is into Z prime, because this is S wave. So this is dominating. Now in this case, you annihilate into Z prime, and the Z prime goes into muons and tauons. And from that, you get photons, which you can constrain. But it happens that the constraints from Fermi are not really relevant at masses above 100 GeV. So everything up here is fine simply because the constraints are not that good. If you go below, these annihilations are via the Z prime and the S channel, and these channels are P wave suppressed. So even in this case, you don't see anything in indirect detection. In the future with CTA, I would expect that you can carve out a little parameter space over here where you have S wave and then muons and tauons that give you some photon signatures. But only in this region where you have S wave and not too far from 100 GeV.
With higher masses, you could have Hess constraints, although they come from the galactic center, there is uncertainty about J factors.
Same, they're not relevant for these masses over here. Because the signal is not that good going into.
Around 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed over the S wave.
This is exactly the thermal cross section, yeah. This is standard S wave thermal relic dark matter. But the signature is a little bit less, right? You first go into the Z primes, and then the Z primes decay, so you're diluting the whole thing and it gets a bit softer, the photon spectrum. All right, let's go to a different benchmark point, because the whole point of mu minus L tau is that you can make it light, the Z prime, and still heavily coupled, or like not too weak. So let's go to the benchmark value where you can explain the G minus 2 anomaly. 10 MeV Z prime, this gauge coupling, you still have the complex scalar dark matter mass and the charge under the mu minus L tau. And again, on the black line, you get the thermal abundance. Above, you would need an additional asymmetry to get the right number of dark matter. And again, everything leads to capture on neutron star muons. Everything can be excluded if you see a neutron star that is colder than 1700 Kelvin. In this case, on the self-annihilating line, you only get this additional increase in temperature from annihilations for masses above like 100 MeV, because for lower masses, the neutrinos that you get out of this, so you're annihilating into Z primes or directly into neutrinos, the neutrinos have such low energy that they even escape the neutron star, so they're not captured anymore. That's why in this case, the additional increase in temperature only is valid up here. But there's something new interesting coming in from the fact that you have such a light Z prime. And that is self-interacting dark matter. You have dark matter that now scatters on itself, mediated by this Z prime. And you can easily reach cross sections over mass of order centimeter squared per gram, which is precisely the interesting region where you could explain some small scale structure anomalies, such as the too big to fail problem, and the core versus cusp problem. So everything above the blue line, so on the blue line, you get this transfer cross-section of a mass of centimeter squared per gram. But since the Z prime is so light, the cross-section is actually velocity dependent. Meaning the cross-sections on dwarf scales, which have velocities of order tens of kilometers per second is different from the cross-section at cluster scales, which have velocities of order thousands of kilometers per second. And that's good, because we don't see the need for self-interaction, self-interacting dark matter on cluster scales. The bullet cluster, for example, is perfectly fine with not having any dark matter self-interactions. So you don't want to live above the cluster line here. But dwarfs seem to require some self-interacting dark matter. So you want to live exactly where the two diverge, because here you have cross-sections of order centimeter squared per gram on dwarf scales, but much smaller cross-sections on cluster scales, which is exactly what you kind of want to explain these small-scale structure anomalies. So this is an additional region of parameter space that only exists in the Elmina-Zeltau model because you have such a low, still strongly coupled Z prime as a mediator. And again, in this case, indirect detection signatures are basically non-existent because the Z prime is so light, it can only decay into neutrinos. So even if you're on the S wave line over here, where you go dark matter into Z prime, which then gives you a box-shaped spectrum for the neutrinos, you don't really see that yet. Neutrino telescopes in this energy region are not that good to give you anything useful. But you could still see it in old neutron stars. That's the point.
You can also have direct annihilation. Kaika is a prime and neutrinos
between. Yes, that's down here. If you are at dark matter masses below Z prime, that's the only channel open. And then the whole thing is additionally P wave suppressed. So not only do you have crazy difficult to detect neutrinos with very low energies, could potentially see only in Borexino, I think. In this MEV mass range neutrino signatures, you can only see in Borexino. But then it's P-wave suppressed, so you don't even need to think about it. Okay, I guess I should skip the anti-helium. Let me come to a mini summary of what I said so far. So again, this is the global symmetry group of the standard model, which you can easily promote to a gauge symmetry. And you can also easily add a dark matter particle that is coupled to it, which you can use for the dark matter stability. And you can use the Z prime as a portal to this dark sector. In most cases, you get strong constraints from direct detection. The least constrained case is, again, Elmina-Zeltau, because this evades direct detection, but you would still capture it on neutron stars. So no matter which linear combination you use here, your dark matter will scatter on something, be it Earth, be it neutron stars. So there's still hope to constrain even this very secluded Z prime portal with upcoming telescopes. In addition, the Elmina-Zeltau case is also interesting because you allow for large self-interactions, which you can use to explain core versus cusp and too big to fail problem. And I guess I should skip to the end.
You can 5 minutes.
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can take some minutes, no problem. 5-10 minutes.
Okay, 5-10 minutes. Everything I've said so far assumed that we have absolutely stable dark matter because we picked the right charges for dark matter, right? But you can also pick numbers that only make it stable at the renormalizable level. For example, if you have a dark matter that carries, that is a fermion dark matter that carries 3 units of lepton number, then it can still decay into 3 neutrinos. But in order to make that decay happen, you need some higher dimensional operators, or you need some UV mediators that connect the lines like this. At the renormalizable level, in general, this doesn't happen, but you can make models where it does happen. So it's just like in the proton decay case, right? At the most basic level, it's stable because of renormalizability, and you don't add all the higher dimensional operators. But you can easily add stuff like leptoquarks that make it unstable. So it's the same situation here. If you pick special numbers, you can still have a decay, but this decay will be typically very slow because it has to go through some mediators in order to make it happen. More interesting is if you give the dark matter baryon number minus something, because then it can only decay into anti-baryons. And this could be interesting because AMS, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer on top of the International Space Station, which has been running since 2011, collects antimatter, right? They measure cosmic rays, and they've measured a lot of protons, deuterons, helium. But their main point is measuring antimatter. And so far, they've measured about 1 million antiprotons compared to 10 billion protons. They won't tell us what the anti-deuteron number is, but they did mention that they've seen about 8 anti-heliums so far compared to 700 million normal heliums. So about every 100 million heliums, you get one anti-helium apparently. This is not published yet. They've been mentioning this for years. They keep running simulations to figure out what's the misidentification rate in their detector, to figure out whether 1 in 10 to the 8 heliums can just have a misidentified sign in the charge, even though they have a redundant system of measuring these things. So we still have to await the official publication to figure out what the actual flux is. They don't even give you the numbers. And what the significance of these events is, whether or not you should have expected some on account of this large background. But it has still sparked some interest in the community because it is such an odd signal to have anti-helium. You would not have expected this from any place until they came out with this number. And now people have re-evaluated the potential for anti-helium, both in terms of astrophysics and from new physics, and basically find that it's impossible to get it from astrophysics, and it's very difficult to get it from dark matter. And in both cases, you make anti-helium from coalescence. This is, you start stacking up anti-nuclei by stacking up anti-protons and anti-neutrons on top of each other.
Is
so,
like original AMS was built on the premise looking for anti-helium as that they would for like regions of antimatter in the universe, right? And so on, some of the anti-heliums making glass. As far as I recall,
you can find the odd sentence in the original AMS motivation that tells you that it would be groundbreaking to see even one anti-helium. Because this would hint at antimatter regions because there wasn't any expectation to see it from any other reason. So the reason for this is this coalescence model, which tells you that there's a hierarchy of anti-nuclei, and it becomes more and more improbable to make heavier and heavier anti-nuclei, as you would expect. If you want to put in numbers, it's basically a factor 10 to the minus 4 at every step. Making it crazy if you look at this, right? None of this fits this. In particular, having 2 antihelium 4 and 6 antihelium 3 is not at all what you would expect. But even the antihelium 3 compared to the million antiprotons is not what you would expect. So either there's something very wrong with this coalescence model, which is by all means just a pheno approach of modeling this and is difficult to actually calculate or measure in the lab, or there's something else going on. But first, let's look at what you would expect. So this is from a paper by Korsmeyer et al. About the anti-helium flux. This is the flux. This is the kinetic energy per nucleon. Typically, they give you like that. And since AMS doesn't give you the actual flux they measured, this is roughly what they said they would be sensitive to in terms of anti-helium 3. So if they see something, it should be in here, I guess. And these people have calculated what the astro prediction is, and you can see it doesn't reach the expected part. So you expect 0 antihelium events, much less antihelium 4. Other people find different things. So this is a paper by Marco Cirelli where this is the most optimistic case. When you push the coalescence momentum to high values, the coalescence momentum is basically you expect things to bind into nuclei if their momenta are in a sphere given by this value. You would normally expect this to be around 200 MeV. This is the go-to benchmark value for this. If you push it to much higher values, 600 MeV, then you can indeed reach the AMS sensitivity region, both for this dark matter model in red and for the background. But you have to push this coalescence thing, so the unknown parameter in these coalescence models, to very high values.
So if you take the 6 events per however many years, do you know where that actually falls?
No, because they don't give you the actual momenta for these things. They have given you, so there's 8 events, sorry, there's There's eight events. They have given one momentum for helium 3 and one event, one momentum for antihelium 4, and it was around 30 GeV per nucleon, and this was about 40 GeV per nucleon. So somewhere here. But since we don't know any of the other things, it doesn't really help you.
Yeah.
It's difficult to know what the flux is that they see based on six events that they. Right. So generically, what people always assumed is that dark matter would lead to antinuclei at low momenta, whereas the background should go to high momenta. But yeah, again, we don't have enough information from AMS. This doesn't really help at right now.
And helium 4, they're not supposed to see at all.
They're not supposed to see at all. No one ever claimed that you could get this ever. So again, the main thing is that if you try to push the flux of helium 4, of antihelium 3, you also typically push up the antiproton flux, and we've measured that. So whenever you try to increase the rate of antihelium, you typically run into problems with the measured antiproton flux. And this is illustrated here in a paper by Stefano Profumo, where they again show the flux versus the kinetic energy, and now they fix their rate of antihelium 3 to 1 per year. No matter what the kinetic energy is, they just fix the antihelium flux for two different dark matter masses going into BB bar. Just focus on the blue regions. I'm not sure if you can see it. This is the blue region for antiprotons. This is the prediction starting from this flux for antihelium 3 and using a coalescence momentum that is very much at the edge of what is reasonable. Pushing it really, really high, which essentially pushes down the prediction for the antiproton flux, right? You wanna get them closer together. So they figure that with the right coalescence momentum, they can push this antiproton prediction down to this region, which aligns okay with the measured antiproton data from from AMS. You would expect more of a spectrum, more of a spectral feature here. If you go by their model for coalescence, but it's finally compatible. So here in this case, they managed to make the proton flux compatible with the measurement. On the antideuteron side, we only have constraints so far from BESS. This is on the antideuteron flux, and these are the expected sensitivities of AMS on antideuterons and from gaps. And this is the blue is the antideuteron prediction that they get by fixing, again, the antihelium flux. And you can see that you should see something in AMS for antideuterons. Since they haven't given us anything, this is not useful yet. Moving on, so this looks fine, right? This looks like you can do it with dark matter. The actual cross sections that they need to generate this antihelium flux are around here, which are both about a factor of 2 above the limits of Fermi. They argue that you can always argue a little bit with the J factor in terms of these for these indirect detection limits, so that they're already formally excluded is not that bad because it's only by a factor of 2 or 3, and this is only a small tension. But you should know that it is crazy difficult to get antihelium 3 from dark matter. You have to push both the unknowns in the coalescence momentum, and you have to somehow get rid of these standard indirect detection limits from dwarf galaxies.
When
yeah.
Coalescence momentum, are we just assuming all the particles come in with that fixed momentum? Or is it actually a spectrum centered around that momentum data?
They simulate this annihilation and then let it hadronize with, I think, Pythia.
So that just gives you the spectrum of like anti-neutrons and protons, like that, right?
Yeah, and I guess on.
The statement probably is that if the particles are the same as relative transverse momentum, there is a certain probability of the form.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. But I'm not sure if they're actually using that that angular part of the information. I'm not sure if they're going that far with this simulation. I'm not sure, maybe they're just setting cuts on for every of these annihilations, I get so and so many antiprotons, which is maybe what Pythia can give you. And then some of them will have momentum smaller than the coalescent momentum, so I expect them to maybe form with other antiprotons or antineutrons. I'm not sure how sophisticated this simulation is, this calculation of the antinuclei fluxes. It's very difficult because we don't really have a good model for coalescence. That's why you have these huge bands, right? This is all uncertainty in the coalescence momentum, pushing it to the maximal reasonable values. All right, so I convinced you, you don't get any antihelium from just standard astrophysics, secondary, tertiary processes. It's even difficult to get it from dark matter, and you will certainly know once AMS gives you more data on antiprotons and, more importantly, antideuterons. Either way, it's impossible to get antihelium-4 from anything, which is why it was always hailed as the definite proof for antimatter regions. Going back to Dolgov and Silk, there could be secluded regions of antimatter where you have antihelium-4 just from chemistry, and they could then show up in your detector. This was recently re-evaluated by these people, and they found that you kind of need an anisotropic Big Bang nucleosynthesis to have the right ratios of helium of antihelium-3 to antihelium-4 to antiprotons. So you want to change the chemical abundances a little bit compared to what we know from BBN in order to get these numbers right for the antihelium-4. In addition, as always, if you have antimatter regions, you need to seclude them from matter like crazy, because otherwise we would see on the boundary meta-antimatter annihilations, and then very characteristic photons. So you either need to hide this very well, or you need to put it in compact objects. So they're also proposing that you could have anti-stars or something like that, that are easier to hide because they're compact. Easier.
You can have anti-solar winds, right?
Yeah, that brings, yeah. Sure, you still need to seclude it. Even in that case. And in addition, you also need some way to accelerate the antihelium-4, which you can maybe get from this mechanism, to get it to AMS. Because this just gives you very low momentum antihelium-4, if at all. So this is by now the best way to get antihelium-4. It's not great, but this is the standard proof that if you see antihelium-4, it's antimatter regions. We thought, together with Arvind Rajamaran, that there must be a better way along the lines of what I said so far. If you have dark matter with anti-baryon number, maybe you can dominantly let it decay into anti-helium without kicking up the flux into anti-protons.
Can we just maybe flash the idea, and then if there are questions, you can go in more details.
Okay, it's basically done. Okay. So as a simple toy model, let's take a complex scalar with baryon number -3, and then obviously assume that baryon number is sufficiently conserved, so this determines in what kind of things it can decay. It has to go into 3 baryons, and then for Lorentz symmetry, it also has to have another fermion in there, so this is an effective operator that could lead to the decay. This conserves baryon number and leads to the decay of phi into antiproton, antineutron, and positron. And if the mass of the scalar is very high, this is exactly what you get. It decays into these 4 particles. But if the mass of this scalar is close to the helium-3 mass, it will dominantly start to decay into the bound states. Not only because you get the additional binding energy from not going into these individuals, but going into antideuteron or even antitritium, which then goes into antihelium-3, but also because you gain phase space from the fact that you go into a 2-body state or 3-body state compared to this 4-body state. So all of this enhances the ratio of antihelium-3 over antideuteron or antiproton. So if you're close enough to the helium-3 mass, it seems that you can get arbitrarily many antihelium-3s without getting too many antiprotons, right? Which is great. This is exactly the opposite of what you get from the coalescence mechanism. Now it only comes down to, can you get enough antihelium-3? Can you push the rate up enough? This is an effective operator. Here we took the effective scale to be something that looks reasonable, 10 to the 4 TeV. The decay rate here is around the age of the universe or longer, so it seems that you can make this thing easily dark matter and it just decays. But if it's just dark matter, it will be cold and lead to low momentum anti-helium 3, so you still need a mechanism to kick this up to AMS. Alternatively, you could just consider this as a second part of a dark sector and have some other particle that decays or annihilates into this, boosts it, and then it decays into anti-helium 3, which then gives you the momentum. That should be fine. The main issue in this case is the UV completion. So this is an effective operator with nucleons, but in the end, this has to come from a quark operator, right? Every nucleon has three quarks in there. So the actual operator will have a UV scale that comes with the 12th power, not the third power here. Now when the three quarks condense into a nucleon, you get a lambda QCD for every quark. So in the end, your 1 over lambda to the 3 here in this operator is actually this. And this lambda UV to the 12th, this is the scale that you would expect for the masses of the mediator particles, the leptoquarks and all the stuff that gives you this operator, right? On which you have constraints from the LHC. Colored and electric new particles shouldn't be at scales below TeV. But it turns out if you plug in these reasonable values for lambda, you find that lambda UV here comes out in the 10 GeV range, because this huge lambda QCD to the 9th suppression suppresses this operator already sufficiently. So suddenly the operator here, or suddenly the anti-helium production in this model is not constrained from the fact that we've seen antiprotons, but rather from the LHC, because we've not seen the colored mediators that could give you this operator. It's a completely different constraint on the maximal number of anti-helium 3 that you could get. But in this case, it is strong enough to make it impossible to get the right number of anti-helium 3 from this operator. There is a quick fix that we thought of, where you don't just decay into anti-tritium and the positron, but you also decay into a second particle here. And you assume them again to be almost degenerate, so that you're close to the so that the mass difference is close to the anti-helium 3 mass in order to dominantly go into this two-body state and not in the individual antinucleons. And then you can expect a decay chain like this, where the quarks that are emitted are very low momentum because the phase space is so small for all of them, right? You assume that phi 1 and phi 2 have roughly the same mass, leaving only very little energy for all these quarks, which will bind into neutrons, protons, and then eventually tritium or anti-tritium, to be honest. So they carry a very, very low momentum, which means if you also make these xis roughly degenerate with the phi 1 and phi 2, you will find resonances on all of these lines. If they're all roughly degenerate, you can hit enough of these resonances to compensate for this additional lambda QCD suppression over here and kick up the rate for this decay, even if these particles are at the TeV range. Obviously, it's becoming more complicated, but this is the best thing we could think of to get a large rate of anti-helium from TeV scale physics without running into problems with anti-protons or anti-deuterons. In principle, you can do the same thing for anti-helium 4, which was the main point. But in this case, it becomes even more elaborate because you need more quarks, and it becomes more difficult to simply calculate what the decay rates are into anti-helium, anti-deuteron, and anti-protons, because it's becoming more complicated on the nuclear physics side. But in principle, this is a new model-building avenue to explain higher anti-nucleon rates than expected. And that brings me to the summary. So I try to convince you that the standard model has this nice global symmetry, which you can gauge for free. For Dirac neutrinos, you would expect to see any of this in CMB stage 4 because it contributes to an effective. For Majorana neutrinos, you should see something in neutrino scattering in one way or another. And you can use the Z prime for dark matter and stability. The one massive exception in all cases is L mu minus L tau, which is so weakly constrained that you can get G minus 2 explained. You could even, in a different region, get the B2S anomalies. And since it's such a light mediator, potentially you can get self-interacting dark matter. And still, you cannot hide it completely. It will be captured in neutron stars and could potentially be observed by the James Webb Space Telescope. Independent of the Z prime coupling, you can use the baryon numbers and lepton numbers that the dark matter carries to maybe make one decay mode dominant for dark matter, and this could potentially lead to larger antihelium fluxes than expected. So thank you for your attention.
Do they give us any hope on more definitive statement about helium?
No. This is from this year. There was a workshop on D-bar, and they still haven't given any. They still haven't said anything about a future publication soon or anything like that. They keep saying they have simulated millions and millions of events, but they still need more, and they even throw out the word years to simulate enough events to get the right misidentification rate. So still nothing concrete from them. Even on the anti-deuterons, this should be much easier. Yes. Yeah. Because again, the background is like 10 to the 8 in the anti-helium case, so you need enough statistics on the simulation side, and this is apparently difficult.
Other questions? Thank you, Len, again.